Oh, hey there. You like true crime stories, right? Yeah, I know. Who doesn't? But I gotta admit, after a while, all those stories of murder and heartache, well, they tend to go straight to my hips. So that's why I, Leroy Luna, have created a podcast called Excuse Me, That's Illegal, where we'll take a hardcore look at some softcore crimes. No TED Talks on Bundy here. The letters BTK won't be coming from these lips. Unless he had a brother that used to steal library books. Suppose I'd be willing to go balls deep into that one if that were the case. Anyways, you'll hear stories such as the Mad Pooper, a female jogger who wreaked havoc in a Colorado Springs neighborhood, using one family's front yard as her own personal dumping grounds. If this kind of content sounds like it's up your alley, Excuse Me, That's Illegal, is available right now on all your favorite podcatchers. So come join me.
I'll be right here waiting for you.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Family curses are usually stuff of haunting novels, campfire ghost stories, and urban legends. But there are famous cases of real people, wealthy and privileged, who seemingly suffer with family curses. The Kennedy family, American royalty, are probably the most famous, and other famous families mired in tragedy are the Gettys and the Hemingways. But today I'm discussing a Southern family that isn't world famous, though well known in Arkansas and parts of Tennessee. The Snowden family enjoyed wealth and privilege for generations and were known for their civic benevolence. The iconic Snowden House in Horseshoe, Arkansas, was originally a simple farm. In the 20s, Robert Snowden Jr. transformed his farm and the entire Horseshoe community into agricultural success. And eventually, he and his wife redesigned the farmhouse into the luxurious Snowden House, originally known as the Horseshoe Plantation. At least three generations of their family lived and loved in the historic home before tragedy struck. Three family members would be murdered in the Horseshoe Lake properties, one in the infamous Snowden House. Their murders were separated by almost two decades, but united by one common evil. A man who had been forgiven and given redemption by a Snowden great-granddaughter before he betrayed her. Today, the historic Snowden House, a place of so much beauty and happiness before this tragedy, remains closed. Welcome to episode 126, The Snowden Murders. Horseshoe Lake is a quaint bedroom community located within the larger Crittenden County of Arkansas. Like the rest of the South, before European settlers came to the area of Crittenden County, Native Americans of the pre-Mississippian and Mound cultures inhabited the area. Many artifacts have been found in the area dating back to 600 AD, and some of the Native American mounds still exist, surrounding Horseshoe Lake. Many of these mounds, like much of the memory of these cultures and peoples, have been eroded over time through settlements, agriculture, and farming throughout the area. After European settlers arrived, they were quick to notice that the proximity of Horseshoe Lake to the Mississippi River meant that the land was prone to flooding, making it difficult to inhabit. Nonetheless, following the War of 1812, land grants were given to soldiers as payments for their enlistment, and these men began to settle the area, develop businesses, and create the foundation for their modern town of Horseshoe Lake. These people soon realized the Mississippi River flooding replenished the rich soil of Crittenden County, creating an agriculture economy, especially in cotton. There were many plantations in the area, as there were in Louisiana and nearby Memphis. Thousands of African enslaved men and women worked the land and remained as tenant farmers after the Civil War. Horseshoe Lake played a role in the Civil War, where soldiers from the Confederacy, many coming from the surrounding area of the southern states, fought against the Union Army. According to historian Margaret Woolfolk, it is believed that the Horseshoe Lake area was even the site of a skirmish with Texas Rangers during the Civil War. Different homes around Horseshoe Lake served as hospitals for soldiers on both sides of the war front. After the end of the fighting in 1865, the state of Arkansas rebuilt around these homes. Horseshoe Lake's proximity to Memphis, Tennessee, just 30 miles away, made the area a thriving place for musicians at one point in time. Blues greats, including B.B. King, Howlin' Wolf and Herbert Sumlin once played in juke joints within the plantations surrounding the community. Today, the town of Horseshoe Lake is made up of a community of retirees, with a population of just about 300, according to the latest census data. Despite the changing times and updated big cities nearby, the rich history of the area is not lost on its current residents, many of whom are the ancestors of those who helped develop and incorporate the town. These residents enjoy the easygoing, peaceful, and quiet community, fishing spots, and lakefront views from their properties. Family names that are widely known around Horseshoe Lake, Arkansas, and Memphis, Tennessee are Brinkley, Snowden, and McKay. The Brinkleys and the Snowdens helped develop both Horseshoe Lake and Memphis after the Civil War, with the building of expensive, beautiful homes and their sense of philanthropy. The first Snowden who came to America was John Snowden from Scotland in the 1600s. His descendant, Robert Bogardus Snowden, was a colonel in the Civil War, serving under Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Following the Civil War, he was involved with several different industries in the area between Memphis and Horseshoe Lake, including real estate and banking. Much of his work was in an effort to rebuild the city and the South after the war ended. Though his time in the Civil War was long finished, Robert was affectionately referred to as the Colonel throughout the rest of his life. His continued mark is seen with Snowden Avenue in the Midtown area of Memphis, and of course with the Snowden School in Memphis, which is over 110 years old now. The Colonel married Annie Overton Brinkley, and as a wedding present, Annie's father, Robert Brinkley, the same man who built the famous Peabody Hotel in 1869, purchased a massive estate in Memphis and named it Annsdale in her honor. Annsdale, now used as an event space and wedding venue, was owned by the Snowden family for 160 years, and at one point served as one of the Civil War hospitals. Annie and the Colonel had a son who was also named Robert, but was referred to as R. Brinkley. R. Brinkley followed in his father's footsteps and became a prominent land developer and real estate baron. He built the famous Ashlar Hall Mansion in 1896, which still sits on Central Avenue in Memphis, and lived in the home with his family. Later that year, within the halls of their great home, R. Brinkley's son was born, named Robert Bogardus Snowden Jr., known as Bob. Bob Snowden grew up within the city of Memphis and chose to study architecture at Sewanee, a small Episcopal liberal arts college in Tennessee. He was again following in the footsteps of the other men in his family. It was there at Sewanee that he met a woman named Grace and fell in love. Their initial plans to marry and settle down were thwarted by the First World War and Bob's enlistment into the forces as a pilot. While Bob fought in the war, Grace became trained as a nurse and volunteered to help wounded soldiers regain their strength as she waited for her love to return from battle. The couple married after the end of the war in 1918. Bob and Grace looked for a place to settle down, and because Bob wanted to farm, they flew to the area of Horseshoe Lake, Arkansas. Up above the trees, he spotted a large patch of land that he wanted to claim as his own. He built a house that would become a historic home for generations until tragedy struck just a little over a year ago. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Bob and Grace Snowden originally built a simple farmhouse on the huge property. It only had one bathroom, but it had screened-in porches overlooking the magnificent view of the lake. Within a few years, thanks to the rich soil and their good fortune, the crops of 1,000 acres of cotton were thriving. Always having been interested in aviation, and with his knowledge of being a pilot in the war, Bob eventually ventured back into the airplane business, starting Command Air, a plane manufacturing company. Before long, the business was selling their custom machinery and gaining traction within the aviation industry. However, following the Great Depression, the business struggled, and Command Air closed shop, and Bob decided to return to farming. According to an Arkansas Gazette article, he said, "As an airplane manufacturer, I turned out to be a damn good farmer." Bob's innovative soil rebuilding program predated government programs that would help agriculture all over the nation. Bob and Grace were also known for their flair and parties. In 1930, Bob arranged the first annual Horseshoe Aeronautical Sweepstakes, a scavenger hunt for pilots using their private planes to fly around Horseshoe Lake. In the 1960s, Bob had created the Horseshoe Plantation Corporation, which embraced the farmland, some industrial property, and more than 30 cabins along the lakefront. Bob and Grace were a revered couple, revitalizing the area and chairing many boards and charitable institutions, a legacy that would characterize their family in years to come. And they were loving parents to 3 daughters and 1 son. And as their family grew, they needed more space to accommodate their children. In 1949, they began renovating the 1-story farmhouse on the property to a grand 6,000-square-foot 3-story home. In reference to this renovation, their granddaughter, Martha McKay, told a reporter from Memphis Magazine, quote, "My grandparents were world-class travelers, and they had seen an antebellum plantation home in Louisiana, and that's supposedly what my grandmother patterned this home after." As time went on, the Snowdens eventually became grandparents. They hosted large family events, fun gatherings, and celebrations on their property for the entire Snowden family. Martha McKay told Memphis Magazine that her grandmother Grace, quote, "was a lady in the formal sense of the word, dignified, well-mannered, and graceful. I never met anyone like her. She lived a privileged life, to be sure, but she was grateful for her blessings and made it a point to raise us with a sense of appreciation for the beauty of life." Eventually, some members of the Snowden family moved outside of the Horseshoe Lake property. In December 1941, Bob and Grace's daughter Sally was a senior at Vassar College. She married recent Princeton graduate and petty officer in the Navy, Henry Hughes, then finished up her chemistry degree at Vassar. Although 10 years later, they would divorce due to, quote, indignities. Sally remarried within a year on July 11, 1952. She married David McKay and would go on to have 3 daughters with him, Grace, Katie, and Martha. The newlyweds farmed in the area for a time before they moved to San Francisco. Despite living in California, every summer, Sally would take her children back to the Snowden house and let them stay there until school began again. Sally's daughter explained, "Mother would bring us back for the summer and leave us there. It was just wonderful. Everything was fresh from the garden, fresh eggs and all. We even had a peach orchard. We got to swim every day. It was just ideal. Both my grandparents just loved having a house full of kids, and they showed it." In 1976, Sally McKay filed for divorce for a second time and moved back home, where she was known as Miss Sally. She split her time between a house at Horseshoe Lake and a house 35 minutes away in Memphis. In both of her hometowns, Sally was an active part of her community. She owned her own CPA business, and she opened up an antique store, and she was also on the board of Playhouse on the Square. She also leased out many houses around the Horseshoe Lake community, which had a population of around 300 people. Sally McKay was known as a lively character. According to a 1996 Commercial Appeal article, Sally preferred jeans and sandals and also smoked Camel cigarettes. When she turned 70, she celebrated in the Virgin Islands with friends. They rented a 43-foot sailboat and went snorkeling while naked. Sally's friend Karen Shea told the Commercial Appeal that Sally was, quote, "anti-mame, full of life and happiness. She was always up for a trip and a good time." In 1982, longtime patriarch Bob Snowden passed away at the age of 86. His wife Grace followed in 1989 at the age of 91. Both are buried on the property, where their simple granite headstones remain. And Miss Sally was now considered to be the matriarch of the family. Following their deaths, the Snowden daughters divided some pieces of property for themselves and managed the rest of the Snowden property together. Sally lived in one of the many Snowden homes close to the Horseshoe Plantation, or Snowden House, as it was now known. And Miss Sally was now its official manager. Sally leased the Snowden House to different businesses over time, including, at one time, a restaurant and bed and breakfast. For years, the house was used this way, with many members of the Memphis and Horseshoe Lake communities using the space as the setting for bridal showers, big dinners, and weddings. The house even caught the attention of the filmmakers of the 1994 thriller The Client, based on the John Grisham novel, starring Susan Sarandon and Tommy Lee Jones. The film used the home as one of their main backdrops in the movie, only increasing the interest that locals had in the space. It's safe to say that the Snowden family enjoyed its fair share of privileges and perks that usually only come with generational wealth. But the family also endured an unfair share of tragedy, starting first in 1996. On September 10th, 1996, local Bobby couples found Sally's red Toyota around a mile from the Snowden house. According to a Commercial Appeal article, the car was still running and was badly damaged when it hit a tree and rolled over on a gravel stretch. The windshield showed the circular impact of a head hitting the glass, and police speculated the driver was injured. After finding the car, Bobby drove to a local shop to see if the owner, Levi Glasper, knew whose car it was. Levi told him it belonged to Sally McKay. He said he never saw Sally driving down the road where her car was found. The two men jumped in Bobby's car and headed to Sally's house. When they got there, the men noticed her nephew, Lee Baker's truck, was backed up to the back door with the tailgate open. No one could get in through that door. Levi ran to the front of the house and put his hand on the window, and it was hot. They drove back to Levi's shop so they could call the local fire department. Bobby and Levi drove back to Sally's and started using a winch to pull Lee's truck away from the house. Once the truck was far enough away, Levi tore off the screen door. They were able to put the fire out within a few minutes, but inside Sally's house, Levi saw two burned bodies and knew it was too late. The fire was pretty much limited to the living room and kitchen area. When police arrived, they found the dead, charred bodies of 75-year-old Sally McKay and her 52-year-old nephew, Lee Baker. They had been killed sometime between 10:30 a.m. and 11:15 a.m. These were the first homicides ever recorded in Horseshoe Lake, as an autopsy showed that Sally and Lee had been shot before the house was set on fire. Police searched the area where Sally's wrecked car was found via helicopter. Then they started canvassing homes. Lee Baker, who was born in 1944, was the son of Sally's sister Edith. Not only was Lee part of the Snowden family line, he was also a well-known blues musician. Starting in 1965, Lee played guitar with blues legend Furry Lewis. After Furry's 1981 death, Lee married a woman named Carol and had three sons. He taught English at Hughes High School. Then in the late 1980s, Lee started a band called The Agitators. In 1996, the band had saved up enough cash to release their first album. That money was being stored at Lee's house, along with many items of blues memorabilia Lee had collected. Ironically, firefighters had been called to a fire at Lee's home almost exactly a month before the fire at Sally's house. On August 12th, the Baker's Horseshoe Lake house was destroyed by a fire. Lee and his family lived in a house that was only 100 yards from Sally's home. Lee helped Sally with a lot of the business for the properties. By the time the firefighters had arrived, it was too late. The house was destroyed, and so was everything inside, including Lee's blues memorabilia and the cash he had stashed to pay for the album printing. The fire was so hot that it melted the paint off one of the fire trucks, and the fire was being investigated as an arson when Sally's house went up in flames. Lee's sister-in-law, Susie Blanchard, told the Commercial Appeal that because of the August fire, Lee's wife, Carol, doesn't even have a picture of her husband. She has nothing. Police continued to search for the killer, but for weeks, they had no luck as worried residents locked their doors for the first time. Then on November 5th, 16-year-old Travis Lewis was arrested at his home across a field from Sally's. Travis lived with his mother Gladys in a residence they rented from Sally McKay. Gladys worked in the Snowden house as a housekeeper, and her son Travis actually attended Hughes High School, where he was a student in Lee Baker's English class, so he knew both of his victims personally. Travis had just recently celebrated a birthday and had been 15 when the crimes were committed, but he was charged as an adult with one count of burglary and two counts of capital murder since the murders occurred during another felony. He was later charged with arson. If Travis was found convicted of capital murder, he could have been given the death penalty, which most members of Sally and Lee's families did not want. This was the first time Travis was charged as an adult. As a juvenile, he had been charged with aggravated assault and other juvenile offenses. Residents were shocked that Travis was arrested for the murders. He came from a respected and well-liked family that had lived in the Horseshoe Lake area for years. A local, Beth Baldwin, said that Travis was real polite Everything is yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Plus, he's smart. He's above average in school. He's so soft-spoken, you have to listen to him real close or you couldn't hear him. A Lewis family friend, Mary Couples, said that Travis never gave you any trouble. He didn't have an attitude. I still think there's somebody else, and he's probably too terrified to say anything. She wasn't alone in the thought that Travis hadn't committed these heinous murders on his own. Many locals agreed, including family members of the Snowdens and McKays. But the police weren't shocked. In fact, they had plenty of dealings with Travis. Since September 8th, he had been charged with 4 misdemeanors, including a curfew violation, 3 counts of criminal mischief, littering, and aggravated assault. Some of those charges stem from Travis throwing rocks and bottles at police cars. And police continued to investigate the murders as Travis was held without bond. During the probable cause hearing for Travis Lewis, the judge appeared surprised at what the prosecution had to offer. The prosecutor said there were 3 criminal informants accusing Travis of 2 counts of capital murder and 1 count of burglary. The judge asked if the prosecution had anything in a narrative form, and the prosecution said no, but that during the investigation, Travis had become a suspect, and that the police, quote, had evidence tying him to the scene. The prosecutor said Travis was subsequently interviewed and had made a statement that confirmed his presence at the scene. Police told the media that it was just, quote, good detective work that led police to Travis. And yet they would not say what that evidence was. The prosecution said that due to possible additional defendants and the possibility of additional charges, they didn't want to reveal too much. The judge asked if Travis had made a confession to breaking in, and the prosecutor said yes. When asked if Travis confessed to the murders, the prosecutor said, Judge, I have not seen the statement. I don't have that information. The defense said there wasn't enough evidence to hold Travis, but the judge, the same one who the Memphis Three had been before, ordered him held anyway. Police eventually gave their theory on what happened on September 10th, 1996. Travis had entered the home, expecting to burglarize the house and make it out before anyone could catch him. Instead, he was surprised by Sally and Lee. In a panic, Travis fatally shot them, rounded up the items he planned to take with him, and set the house on fire, presumably in hopes of destroying any evidence left at the scene. Travis's circuit court date was set for April 7, 1998 in Marion, Arkansas. As he stood before the judge, now 17-year-old Travis Lewis pled guilty to both murders. Despite his guilty plea, Travis never actually confessed to the murders and maintained that someone else had killed the two. Because he was charged as an adult in the case, Lewis was sentenced to 28 and a half years in prison, and he would have to serve at least 70% of that sentence. Following the sentencing, the deputy prosecutor told a local newspaper, quote, the families felt it would be traumatic to go through a trial. Following the murder of their mother and cousin, Martha McKay and her sister Katie Hutton were left to pick up the pieces of their lives. Hutton recalled that, quote, Martha was devastated, like we all were. One of Sally's sisters took over the management of the Snowden property following her murder. Martha returned to Memphis for a time after she had settled out west to assist her aunt in getting things back to a stable point. Once things had calmed down a bit, she moved to Nevada for a time and purchased a home. It was during this time that Martha became fond of historical preservation, and she longed to return to the area of Horseshoe Lake and work on the restoration of the Snowden House. In 2004, Martha McKay bought the Snowden House from the rest of her family and began restoring it to its former glory. After the renovations, she moved into the home and also opened up a bed and breakfast within the house. And for over 15 years, she ran a successful business there and also kept the family together there with reunions. There are many smiling photos of Martha and her family on the Snowden House Facebook page. And Martha was featured in many Arkansas and Memphis magazines, as well as architectural pieces for her extraordinary work. It seemed the Snowden-McKay family had overcome the tragedy of losing Sally and Lee. Martha McKay and her family had no idea what hurtful betrayal would shatter the family's happiness again. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. As y'all know, I'm fascinated by all types of crime, whether it's in the South or not. I've found a riveting new podcast I want to share with you called Red Collar. We all know what a white-collar criminal is. A rich CEO gets caught up in the latest financial scandal. Bernie Madoff comes to mind, and even Martha Stewart. But there is an interesting subgroup of these seemingly nonviolent criminals that we don't hear about much. The white-collar criminals who kill. Join host Katherine Townsend of Red Collar as she dives into the minds of these real-life American psychos. These red-collar criminals turn on the people closest to them and will do anything to cover their tracks, even if that means murder. Every Tuesday, Red Collar shares the chilling details of different red-collar crimes that will have you asking, do I have a red-collar criminal in my office, or maybe even in my house? Listen to Red Collar now and every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. Is there something bothering you? Sometimes my anxiety can make me just freeze up. It interferes with my productivity. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. And you can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it is easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Southern. Martha McKay never felt satisfied with the conviction of her mother's killer. She felt bad that Travis Lewis had been convicted of the crime at such a young age, and she suspected that his claims of someone else being involved in the murders was true. Despite pleas from friends and family members not to, Martha McKay set about befriending her mother's killer while he was still in prison for the murders. A longtime Buddhist, Martha worked towards forgiving Travis for the killing of her loved ones. They began to exchange letters back and forth, though there's no record of what these letters contained. After some time, she even rode to the penitentiary with a family friend, who told her it was a bad idea to visit with Travis. Martha's sister warned her against this budding friendship, later telling a reporter she told Martha, quote, "Just stay away from him. It's a bad juju type of thing." But she wouldn't do it. She told People magazine, "We were contacted every time he came up for parole. None of us would okay it except for her." In fact, Martha supported and spoke on his behalf for an early release, and in 2018, Travis Lewis's request was granted. He was released from prison. Now 39 years old, Lewis had served 23 years of his 28-and-a-half-year sentence. Following Lewis's release in 2018, Martha gave him a job helping around the Snowden property and performing handiwork. She really wanted to help Travis. Although her family was dubious of the situation and didn't necessarily agree with Martha's decision to hire Travis, the working relationship had gone smoothly for quite some time. Travis's mother, Gladys, still worked at the home too as the longtime housekeeper for the property, and now she and her son were able to work alongside one another. Things remained comfortable for a while. According to Katie Hutton, Gladys warned her boss, Martha, about getting too close to her son. She told Martha, quote, "Just stay away from Travis because he's going back to his old ways." And not long after, there was a theft in the Snowden home. $10,000 had gone missing from the property, money that had been given in exchange for an elaborate chandelier that Martha had sold. She wrote in her diary, later read by her sister, about the sale and how she had stashed the cash within the Snowden house. Martha's sister told People magazine that Lewis had been at home the day that Martha stored the cash and, quote, The money vanished, and she fired him after the money disappeared. Following these events, 24 years after her mother's murder, Martha McKay was found dead. On March 25, 2020, sheriff's deputies from the Crittenden County Police Department responded to an alarm sent from the Snowden house. When they arrived on scene, two deputies noticed that the back door was open. As they entered the home, searching for signs of a crime in progress, they saw a man attempting to exit the house from a second-story window. The man jumped from the window and onto the lawn before they could get to him. Deputies rushed outside to see the man get into a vehicle and begin driving across the property, but he didn't make it far. His car became stuck and he fled, running towards the lake in an effort to escape them. Without so much as a glance toward the officers running after him, the man jumped into the cold, dark lake. Officers saw his head go under and waited for the man to resurface, but he never did. As more officers arrived on the scene, deputies continued searching the property. They soon found the body of 63-year-old Martha McKay at the top of the grand staircase. Martha had been stabbed and bludgeoned to death. Back outside, the Crittenden County Search and Rescue had been called in to search for the suspect's body. With the help of sonar equipment, they eventually found the drowned man. To the astonishment of investigators, the man was 39-year-old Travis Lewis, the same man that had murdered Martha McKay's mother and cousin 24 years earlier. Following the removal of Travis's body from the lake, an autopsy was conducted. It was learned that he had cocaine, methamphetamine, and marijuana in his system at the time of her murder. While it appears that robbery was the motive, investigators were still baffled about why Lewis would attack a woman who had sought out his friendship and rehabilitation. It would seem Martha had managed to hit the alarm for emergency services before she collapsed, but there are rumors that she was found wrapped in blankets, so maybe Travis actually hit the alarm himself before running. Near her body, investigators found a bag sitting atop a chair, filled with expensive items from the house, along with a bloodied knife. Crittenden County Chief Investigator Todd Grooms released a statement about the crime. According to the statement, it was determined that he intended to steal those items, he says. However, it was not determined whether his intentions were to burglarize McKay's home and she was killed in the process, or if his intention was to murder McKay and then opted to steal the items. Residents of the Sleepy Horseshoe Lake community were shocked and deeply saddened by the murder of Martha McKay. Following the police presence in the neighborhood, one neighbor told Fox 13, "We locked our doors and remained inside and prayed for the best." "It's just a scary thing that happened," the neighbor said. "We're praying for the family." Katie Hutton, Martha's sister, was devastated by her sister's murder. She told People magazine, quote, "There was something about her that people really loved. She left an impression on people. She had that gift. We are all just in disbelief. Martha didn't deserve to be killed. She didn't deserve anything that happened to her." Joe Baker, the son of murder victim Lee Baker, told the news, "It's kind of like a bad dream or deja vu. Like, really, back to this again? For me, it speaks to some of the issues with the parole system in Arkansas. I think that she really felt in her heart that he deserved to be rehabilitated, which I think really speaks to her character after such a tragic event happened to such a close family member. I'm just beyond sad that it turned out this way for her." Today, the Snowden house is closed, but it's clear to the residents of Horseshoe Lake that Martha's memory will live on in the home. "She loved that house," her longtime friend and neighbor Frank Bird told People magazine. Martha McKay was a loving daughter, sister, and aunt who had to endure the pain of losing her own mother to such a thoughtless, avoidable crime all those years ago. Despite this, her caring, kind nature was so strong that she made an unbelievable sacrifice of befriending and forgiving her mother's killer in hopes that she could understand what happened. Travis Lewis took advantage of Martha's nature and betrayed her giving spirit. And then he was swallowed by Horseshoe Lake in what was perhaps a fitting and poetic end to the tragedies he wrought to that peaceful property. The Snowden House venue was sold shortly after Martha's murder, and it remains closed today. Author Marilyn Robinson wrote, "Families will not be broken. Curse and expel them. Send their children wandering. Drown them in floods and fires. And old women will still make songs of all these sorrows and sit on the porch and sing them on mild evenings. Hopefully, as the years pass, the Snowden-McKay family members will heal and be able to celebrate their heritage at Horseshoe Lake once again. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Hannah Newcomb, with additional research by Haley Gray. The episode was edited and mixed by Resonant Recordings. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. As some of you already know, Facebook shut down our original discussion group, but search for the new one, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We still worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, share memes, and delicious recipes. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit asses allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.